It's 100 years since English football produced an occasion such as this, head-to-head, the last match of the season.
The biggest game for Arsenal in the last 20 years.
Liverpool were the team to beat.
It was desire as well as technical ability.
We wanted success. We'd do anything to get it.
The players we played with, a real tight-knit group. It was a family.
I cannot emphasize enough how proud people were.
One more goal and Arsenal will win it.
I thought, that's it. With all the things that were against us.
1 minute to go.
We were running out of time.
Must be seconds left.
Then it all goes into slow motion.
Arsenal come streaming forward now in surely what will be their last attack.
I'm looking straight down the pitch.
And I'm thinking, this is my time. And I'm waiting and waiting.
What are you doing?
I remember shouting, kick it.
It's up for grabs now!
Isn't it lovely to have moments in your life where you think, oh, nothing can beat that?
Yeah. Lee Dixon, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Sends shivers down my spine just listening to the trailer.
Well, the overwhelming sentiment from George Graham, Tony Adams said it as well. You certainly said it. You were one of the major contributors to the documentary. Mm-hmm. Was the gratitude just to have experienced something so unbelievable, frankly?
Yeah, George Graham's line is brilliant, that to have moments in your life that can't be beaten. I just, when he said that, we were filming him in a studio in London, and when he said it, I literally almost started crying in front of him, because it was just such a thing for him to say, because he's so proud of that moment. And we haven't really spoke that much over the years about 89, because obviously it was quite a few years ago, but bringing all the lads back together and creating an environment where they were open and talking about their emotions and stuff, it's quite a unique position to sit and watch footballers spew all this stuff up about what went on in the past and how proud they were. And it really, really, really pleased me what the end product is. And it was, you know, I didn't take very long to say yes to being involved in it. And it's probably the best thing out of football that I've been involved in. It was an astonishing year filming it. It was brilliant.
Mm. I hadn't realised until watching the documentary, I must say, which was really enjoyable, but I hadn't fully realised it had been 18 years for Arsenal. I had just kind of presumed, well, it's Arsenal, there's Chapman back in the day, and they've just been consistently successful, and there's the double team, of course, of 71 that George Graham was on as a player. And I had just presumed that somewhere between 71 and 89 there'd been some big trophies, but it was a proper drought that the club was in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was what hit home to George when he came to the club, because obviously he'd been involved in the playing side of that in the early days and had some success, and then gone off and done his coaching side of things, and obviously ended up at Millwall. And then I think for him the exciting thing was to try and build a side that could recapture some of those glory days, if not just one glory day that he had when he was a player. And so I think he looked at the club, and he says in the documentary about what he saw when he came and how he immediately knew what he needed to do and get some young, hungry players from outside of the club to mix that with the undoubted amount of young talent in the club that he talks about with great fondness. And getting that blend, I think, was exciting for him, because he could see that he could build something from the start and see whether his coaching methods and his skill at picking players would come to any success. And sure enough, that, you know, in this first full season, or my first full season, 89, you know, produced that amazing night.
Yeah, because Merson gets his debut at 18, Michael Thomas and Tony Adams, 17. You came from Stoke. Very interestingly, and it just shows how times have changed, like it's faintly unbelievable that this even was happening, is that one of George Graham's real methods to scout younger, less well-known players is to gather up all the local papers every week and go to the sports section where the local journalist on the beat would be watching the lesser teams week in, week out, and would know the better players and guess his highlighter out and see who keeps popping up routinely. So was that how he came across Lee Dixon, or how did you get the call?
No, absolutely. I think it was a stroke of genius, that from George, that he did that every week. He got those local papers and listened to what the... Because the journalists around the clubs, you know, we had them round us all the time at different clubs. You know, the local guys down at Bury when I was at Bury, and then Stoke. They were around the club all the time. They were around the training ground. They were allowed access. The players knew them all. They were kind of a safe bet to talk to. You weren't going to get stitched up and put on the back of the dailies, and because there was a relationship with these players and these journalists. And so George knew that, and he knew that they would know, and they had their favourites. You know, they watched every single game home and away. So over a period of a season, you would get some sort of an inkling on who was doing well, because they weren't always reported on that accurately in the nationals, but the local papers had the games down to a T. So for him to do that and find that way of scouting, because, you know, the internet wasn't around then and things were a little bit more difficult, a little bit more hands-on. And so he found that sort of unique way of tracking players. And I basically got a call from, was called into the office at Stoke. Mick Mills was my manager then, the ex-England fullback, and called me in one Tuesday morning and said, I've had a call from George Graham, you're going to go and sign for Arsenal. And that was, you know, on a Tuesday morning, I nearly fell off the chair when he said Arsenal, because I just thought that's a bit big for me. You know, I'm quite happy at Stoke. I think I've found my level. But he said, no, the call has come and the club's accepted the offer. Off you go. And George said that he'd been watching me for a long time. He's read all the papers, read all the reports, and he was willing to take a chance on me, because it was a chance. I mean, I'd not played in the first division as it was then. So he didn't know whether I was going to be able to fit in a club as big as Arsenal, but he'd done it before with Nigel Winterburn, who was already at the club, and he took a chance on Steve Bould 6 months after me, who was my teammate at Stoke. And lo and behold, he got me, Bouldy and Nigel for less than £1 million, and which sounds ludicrous these days. And formed a back four along with Tony Adams that was to stand the test of time, really. And so he's got to take, you know, a huge amount of credit for putting that team together the way he did. It was a sensational bit of coaching and scouting.
It's the most famous back four in English football. And, you know, it still gets referred to on television now. I mean, it just is iconic. How does Graham mould you? How does he train you? Because he says to you when you first arrive, you can't defend.
He still says it to me now, to be fair. But that was the first thing he said to me. He said, you know, you can't defend. I need to teach you what to do. And I thought it was a bit harsh. But having been moulded then over a period of 4, 5, 6, 7 years, just religiously doing the same thing every day in a unit, I mean, Nigel talks about it in the documentary about he doesn't think players, today's modern player would do what we did, because it was so mundane, the training. It was so boring, but it worked because we were like a blank canvas, and we had position on the pitch when we started the game, and then he would literally walk you through a virtual 90 minutes about where the ball could possibly be. He had a ball under his arm. He'd set the back four up on the edge of the penalty area, and he'd be 20 yards away from us, and he'd say, right, I'm the ball, here's the ball under my arm. Wherever I go, you react as if that's on a Saturday. We're going to walk through it, and you've got to react to me. So when I walk towards you, what do you do? And we sort of, you know, we'd back off, and then we'd get a certain position on the pitch. I would show the ball inside. Tony Adams would come out to close the ball down, then he went across the pitch, Tony to drop off, Steve Bowler to come up, and then we'd walk through this training session for, you know, it'd just be us four and him, and the rest of the lads would be over on the other pitch doing shooting practice, having a load of fun, enjoying themselves, and we used to do this virtually every day of our life. And then he'd introduced a few a few attacking players. And before long, he introduced forwards against defenders where the whole team basically would take the back four on and a goalkeeper, and we'd have Paul Davis, one midfield player, sitting in front of the back four. That was our only defender in front of the back four. And the whole 11 would play against five of us. And if he get, not only they wouldn't score, they wouldn't even get a shot on target. It was like the goalkeeper might as well have been, you know, having a cup of tea, because we were so drilled in how we kept the ball away from our penalty area that it almost became a boring training session, because the forwards got bored because they never beat us, and we got bored because it was just what we did. Wow. So, but you take that onto the pitch on a Saturday, and those same situations with the ball under George's arm would appear on a Saturday, and you kind of, without knowing it, he'd already told you what to do and where to be and how to react. It's just that they got another 10 players running around trying to put you off doing what you're doing. But it's amazing how easy it becomes when you practice something day after day, week after week.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. That is intense, that to say
is,
the least.
That is amazing. It's genius in a very simple way, but it's genius, I guess.
Mm.
Was he intimidating at that stage? I know, like, there were fines for being late and stuff like that. He was
quite... Yeah, absolutely terrifying. Right. I was scared stiff of him. You know, you do.
Because you were young, or because maybe everyone was a bit intimidated by him?
No, I think everybody was. And anyone who says they weren't, I think, are lying, because he was a very strict, you know, he'd like to laugh and a joke, but at your expense. You know, he would make jokes, and you didn't really make many jokes against him. Well, not to his face, anyway. Mm. We had a laugh behind his back. But yeah, the discipline was bang on. There was no sort of room for movement, or it very rarely give you a second chance. And he instilled a discipline club. And having said that, you know, we were renowned for playing hard and off the pitch as well in regard to socialising. And I'm sure many stories will come out about the Tuesday club and going for a drink on a Tuesday after training and things like that. He would turn a blind eye to things like that, as long as come Saturday you performed and you won the game and you kept a clean sheet, you could kind of get away with things. But as soon as you drop your standards any, you know, one little percent, then he'd jump straight on your back again, and then he would start cracking the whip and you get back to work. And so you kind of knew where you were with him. There was a very strict regime there, but it worked, and it kept a lot of us in check. It kept the team spirit very close, and he didn't mind if you didn't like him. He wasn't bothered about being liked. He wasn't one of those managers who kind of wanted you to be his mate or anything. Not bothered about that. All he wanted to do was win. And his closest player to him was obviously Tony, his captain, who he had on a piece of string, really, and kind of manipulated and moulded Tony into what he wanted him to be. And Tony responded with you know, orders and instructions to us lot. And we kind of respected that, because we knew Tony was his... But it was his boy, and it worked. You know, they both and the team all wanted the same thing, and that was to win things.
One of the really nice aspects of 89, the documentary, we're talking to Lee Dixon here, is some of the archive footage where you see George in action. So here he is laying down the law to the team about fines.
Anybody who's late for, they'll get one life, and after that it's a tenner. You've got the choice. It's either a tenner or 10% of your wages. Now again, I'll give you, if it's done that week, I'll give you to the end of the week to pay the tenner. If you don't pay the tenner, it'll be the following week. I'll just tell Sheila, and she'll just take it out at 10% out of your wages. Not a tenner, 10%.
A tenner. Isn't that great? A tenner. Oh, dear. Why, do you mind me asking? I know it's a personal question. What kind of wages would you have been on in 89?
I was on about 89 first season. I was about 650 pound a week.
Okay. So even then, a tenner was okay.
Tenner, yeah. I mean, but the thing with it, it was because it was cash. You had to pay cash, and so you get on the bus and he's standing there with his hand out because you're late. You know, literally 5 seconds late getting on the coach. You get on it, right, tenner. And so you actually handing over the cash always hurt. It doesn't matter how much money you're on. And so, you know, and he used to put it in his pocket and say, yeah, well, it's for the, you you know, the charity, and it's for this and it's for that. I don't know whether any went to charity, to be honest with you. I might ask George that. I might ask him.
Receipts. So I look, for the purposes of time, we can't kind of go through all the season in massive depth. It's worth stating again to emphasise the place Arsenal were. They were 16-1 at the start of the season, and Liverpool, who obviously we all know very well, that great Liverpool team, were evens, which is quite incredible at the start of the season. So in short, Arsenal start very, very well, beat Spurs early on, top of the table come Christmas, go into the new year. There's a bit of a wobble then, 6 points from six games, and Liverpool gather pace. So all of that is going on. And then, of course, Hillsborough happens.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, quite understandably in the documentary, I mean, that's heavy and that's somber.
Yeah.
Paul Merson kind of just says, look, I really don't like talking about this. You said for you, I mean, you genuinely thought the season would stop. That would be it.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I at the time, I just presumed that it was so traumatic and it was such a big thing that, you know, 96 people, it's just horrific to even think about it now. And it's in the middle of the football, towards the end of a football season, then, and that has still got games to play. How can you... That's what I thought. I just thought, how can you carry on going back to, you know, that excitement that you get to go into a football match and the place, certainly from, I was looking from the player's point of view, how do I get myself in the right frame of mind to try and beat the person I'm playing against and put the ball in the net and fight and do all the stuff that you need to do in order to produce a performance when people have just died at a football match? How does that work? I couldn't really get my head around it. And so when they said, you know, there's a 2-week break, I thought, oh, well, you know, at least it gives me time to try and work out what to do. And I think George gave us a few days off. Then we were back to training. And then it was, you know, he talked about the fact that it's out of our hands. We just have to go and do our job. And it's almost like a relief then. It gives you a... As a footballer, it gives you an out to go back into being a footballer and saying, OK, right, well, other people are going to take care of the other stuff. We've just got to get on with playing. And so you can kind of escape it a little bit from... I felt as if we were not escaping, running away from it, but we were almost allowed to go back to playing. And then it's funny because once you start playing again, it's not like it's never happened, because I still felt the burden of it right up until, I say, in the documentary... literally right up until I passed the flowers over on the night at Anfield to a lady at the front of the cop, right up until that moment, I felt there was a weight in my chest just going, is it right? Is it right that we're still playing football? I didn't realise it at the time, but now when I look back on it, I could feel that heaviness, and passing the flowers over was almost like permission from her and everybody else at Liverpool and the cop, and it was almost saying, oh, no, it's okay, let's play. We need to play this game, and it's quite an emotional point in the film for me, that handing the flowers over.
I mean, it's a really striking image. So, like, if you skip ahead to that final game, everyone knows about at Anfield, you come out in your yellow jerseys up the tunnel, and first out is obviously Adams, who has the flowers. And the way it's done in the documentary is quite clever. No one warns you the flowers are coming. I didn't know that detail from the night, I must say. So I saw Adams with the flowers, and I thought, well, I guess it makes sense for the captain to have the flowers, and then every player after him also has the flowers, and it's into the centre circle and hold them above your heads, and there's an amazing reception from the cop as you're standing in the centre circle holding the flowers up. You know, there's a lot going on there, and they're applauding you. That it's even hard to verbalise what's going on there.
No, it was hugely powerful and a brilliant way to respect the fans that were there, but also the 96 that lost their lives to the club. And I think it was Ken Fryer. We're still to this day trying to find out who it was, but I think it was Ken Fryer that his idea was, no, we should give some flowers to the Anfield crowd. It'd be a really poignant thing to do.
Because I wasn't, sorry to interrupt, I wasn't sure then, so your centre circle, you take the applause. I thought, well, maybe they'll put the flowers down in the centre circle now and someone will run on and clear the pitch. But you all dart off. It's like a training ground drill. You all take off in different directions into the crowd.
It was funny because I used to stand on the Kop. I've been on the Kop twice as a kid because I was a City fan. And my mate was a big Liverpool fan and his dad took us on the Kop once when City were playing, twice actually, when City were playing in Liverpool.
Mm.
So I had my blue scarf on and typical Scouse welcome. They all sort of laughing and joking with me, standing on the Kop with my little bobble hat on. And I think I was about nine at the time. Had a great time. City always got beat there in Liverpool. So I had a little bit of affiliation with the Kop. And so it wasn't planned where we went to give the flowers. It was like, just give the flowers out around the ground. And it was a massive thing for me to give it to the Kop because I thought, no, that's kind of, I feel as if I've got part of it in me.
Mm.
So I, you know, as soon as we did our wave, I was sprinted down the other end to make sure none of the lads got there first.
Mm.
And that's when I met this lady and she was right at the front of the Kop and I gave her the flowers and that's when that moment came when I got permission, if you like, to carry on and compete then.
Almost a certain guilt lifting.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was like, you know, it's okay. And at the time, again, I didn't... This is why this film's so amazing, because it's brought so much stuff back for me, because I was involved in all of the interviews and I was, I was involved in the process. I've got my memories of the night and they're beautifully coloured in for me that I remember, but so much more now because I've heard John Lukic, I've heard Tony Adams, I've heard Michael Thomas, I've heard all the players talk about the same incidents that we've all talked about, but everyone's different. And so mine now is just, it's like a kaleidoscope of that night because I've got all those little inputs of bits that I forgot that they've all filled in for me. So it's just like, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me from that point of view, is that I've got an incredible memory of what went on now that I can compare with the other players. So it's just been, it's just been an amazing ride to actually get to the point of, and when I see the DVD, I mean, I've seen it nine times now because we're going to screenings and we're trying to get around places on ourscreen.com to watch it with people, with fans, because I can't stop enjoying the moments in the film when I watch people watching it. So I don't actually watch the film myself. I watch people watching it. It's just an incredible thing.
Mm. The short version of that night is Arsenal lose to Derby, impossibly lose to Derby, and then draw with Wimbledon in the weeks preceding the final game of the season at Anfield. And short version is you have to go to Anfield, of all bloody places, the team who were evens at the start of the season, the best team in Europe in many respects, and win the game, not just 1-0, but 2-0, or by two goals anyway. And you're hardly going to score three if they score one. So, it's just not the done thing, and it's kind of mission impossible in some respects. You travel up on the day of the game, which was an interesting choice by George Graham. But in light of the way you talked about training every day, you and Adams and Bold and Winterburn, day after day after day after day after day, I really want to get your thoughts on George Graham, who springs, I suppose within the context of your team, this massive shock to go five at the back, to bring in Dave O'Leary with Bold and Adams in front of him. And he wants you pressed right up on John Barnes, no pressure, and he wants Winterburn up on Houghton to stop them getting the ball effectively. And like a number of the players in the in the documentary say, like, we honestly thought, oh my God, he's lost his mind under the pressure. We've blown this. We're screwed.
Yeah. No, that's exactly how we felt, because we played it against United early in the season, and it was a bit of a shock then because he said, you know, we're going with three at the back. And he had it in mind because I think we were playing Liverpool not that long after that game.
Right.
Or should have been scheduled to do it, and obviously it was delayed because of Hillsborough. But so we played a back three, and the two fullbacks pushed in, call it a three or a five or whatever you want to call it, but certainly wasn't a back four. And we drew 1-1 against United, and then he brought it back again at that, you know, the leading up to that game, and it was like, right, okay, so, right. I understood I understood his reasoning behind it. And from my point of view, and Nigel's, I presume, that John Barnes was obviously one of the best players in Europe at the time, and an astonishing talent. And I played against him quite a few times when I was in FA Cup games when I was at Bury, and I think I played against once when I was at Stoke in the Cup as well. So I knew what he was all about and watched him on Match of the Day every week anyway. So, and that was my first full season in the First Division and in the team. So, but he was so good. It made, when he said we're playing three at the back and the fullbacks pushed on, I want you to just go and mark Barnsley, I was like, massive smile came over my face, because although it took me out of my comfort zone, i.e. the back four, it put me in a place where I could just go, right, it doesn't, whatever I do is not going to make any difference in whether we score any goals or not, because having said that, ironically or not, I set the winner up. But I can just go and stand on John Barnes, and it makes my job a lot easier. Mm. And I think George realised that, and that's what these reasons behind it. And he says in the documentary, to cut the supply off, get me really tight to John, and obviously Nigel to Ray, and make it difficult for them to play through their two of their best players, and cut the supply off to their forwards. Yeah. So
it perfect logic as well. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Can't touch on everything that night, clearly. So kickoff's delayed. It's a Friday night kickoff. I mean, it's summer's evening. School's out kind of that week. There's massive delays all the way up to Liverpool. Graham's advice, or the game plan, keep this tight. You all come in and half time it's nil all. He's saying, brilliant, this is great, we'll score one and then we'll score late. And you do score one. And so, I mean, look, we're into the, we almost don't need to describe it all, because everybody knows what happened, and Barnes gets the ball and doesn't take it into the corner. Like, what's a really amazing moment is in those dying seconds, as Lukic has the ball in the Arsenal goal, you've just asked the referee how long. And he says, we're done. And your thoughts as Lukic, I mean, bloody hell, kick the ball, like get rid of it. Like, there's literally seconds left.
Yeah.
He sees you in the right back position, pushed on a bit, and he goes to throw the ball to you. Thoughts? At like the biggest moment of your career, effectively.
I didn't know it was at the time.
Sure.
If I'd have known at the time, I probably would have shanked it in the stand. But
I
definitely didn't want the ball, because I knew there was no time left and John could kick it further than me. But his recollection of why, because I asked John, and I've never asked him this when we were doing the interview, I said, yeah, you know, why did you throw it out to me? And he said to me, when we scored the one goal, I knew then that we couldn't possibly concede, because that means we'd have to get another two. So I went into this ultra state of concentration where I almost burnt all my energy off, because goalkeepers stand there and don't do anything. They just pick the nose down again, walk up and down, make the odd save. So from an energy point of view, they don't burn energy off running around like we do. Well, all their energy is burnt through their brain because of concentration. So he said he'd absolutely drain the tank as far as his energy was concerned, because he knew that he couldn't concede.
Yeah.
So he said, by the time I got the ball on the edge of the box, on the edge of the goal line, and he picked it up, he said, I looked up the pitch briefly and I thought, I haven't got any energy to kick this. And I'm, you know, and that's why I looked and I saw you and I thought, I'll throw it out to you.
Wow.
And I never knew that.
That's
I never
amazing.
Asked him why he threw it. So doing the filming and he told me that, I went, God, that explains it. It explains why you did it. And nobody in anything to do with Arsenal, including myself, wanted John to throw it to me.
Wow.
As I said, I knew exactly what the referee had just said to me, and I thought, if he throws it to me, I'm going to have to take a touch. It's going to take time, and we haven't got any time. But obviously, when he threw it to me, I didn't really have much choice then. It was just kind of try and hit Alan Smith, and please don't shank it and kick it in the stand. And you look at the pitch, and that pitch, and all the pitches in those days weren't the best. It was muddy. There was loads of bobbles on it. It was Anfield. It was at the end of the game. It was, you know, it wasn't the flattest bit of surface on the pitch. And as I sort of took a touch and opened my body up and started looking up, I could see the ball sort of, you know, bobbling up and down underneath my feet. And I was like, oh, my God. So I just put my head down and found, thankfully found Alan with the ball. And, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. Tony Adams said at full time, or it was either at full time or when Thomas, in a very leisurely fashion, you know, doesn't rush the finish at all. Tony Adams said something really remarkable, that at no other stage had this happened to him, but it was either at full time whistle or when the goal went in. I think it was the goal. He said his legs went and he basically
knocked off his feet,
collapsed. Yeah, he collapsed. Never happened to him before or since. You think about that for a second, it's unbelievable. Can you remember those seconds or where you were?
No. What I was really conscious about, and I think you see it in the documentary, that briefly a camera goes onto the pitch low down and you see me walk past, and I'm shaking hands with the Liverpool players because they were devastated. Obviously they had the league, all of the Hillsborough emotions came out, I think, for them as well, to say, you know, we've let the fans down, or whatever they were going on for them individually. And I was very conscious of being as respectful as I could. And so as inside, all I wanted to do was run around like a nutcase. And I did after I shook hands with them. But I was very conscious of how they were feeling. And so I took a bit of time to sort of try and do the right thing. And that's the only thing I remember. I don't remember from then onwards. And I say in the doc, when it just becomes a blur after that, because it was the emotion just was so huge that it kind of, it takes over you, and logical thought and things. I can see why people do daft things when they're in a state of high emotion, because I can't remember an awful lot about what was going on the pitch. And I know for Tony's point of view, he got that feeling that just took him off his feet, and mine was just memory loss.
Wow. Yeah. Eventually, you all ended up in a pub back in London called Winners and played pool with the fans. And were to think of that now, I mean, could you imagine any league winning team going to a boozer or finding a place called Winners and mixing with, I know, shock horror, the general public? There was one guy who was like proudly showing off Alan Smith's tie, which he got from the night all these years later. That kind of magic. Yeah. There was one last thing I want to ask you about. You've been really good with your time.
No worries.
And there's probably not so much you can say about this, but it leaves a mark towards the end, for sure, where Ian Wright, who had grown up in the same estate as David Rowcastle. He's a fan. He's watching, which is, what a lovely thought that is, considering what he would go on to do. Yeah. And Rowcastle means everything to him. So here's Ian Wright just trying to explain why that 89 Arsenal team with David Rowcastle in it meant so much to him.
David's going to be a champion. He's going to be like a winner. You know? So when the whistle went, I just burst into tears. I'm doing it now. I burst into tears because I realised that when he used to stop me on the bridge and he said, you could achieve anything that you want. Just have to excuse me, because when it comes to David and these kind of moments, the enormity of the love that we had and the time we shared, to see him in his moment of triumph after inspiring me to stop smoking weed, to stop messing around, to stop doing those stupid things and focus on winning in life, and to see him when they blew the whistle and, you know, Arsenal done it. It was for me, I felt like I'd done it. I felt like I'd done it.
Well, that gets me every time, that bit. You know what? When I asked Ian, because we all talked about David Rowcastle in our interviews, and we all loved him, but there was nobody who loved him more than Wrighty. And I said to Wright, I phoned Ian up. He's a really good friend of mine, Ian. We're really close. And I said to him, Ian, I said, I really love you to talk about David on the documentary. And he went, really? And I said, yeah, I really want you to be in it. And he goes, but, you know, I just feel as if I'm jumping on the bandwagon a bit. You know, I didn't play then. It's not my film. You know, he didn't. His initial thought was that he didn't want to be in it. And I said, nobody can speak about David like you can about him. And I said, that means more to me than what anybody says about you being in the film. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care whether they go, well, what's he doing in it? Who cares? I'm helping make this movie. I want you to be in it. I want you to talk about David because I know how much you loved him, and you can get that over to people watching better than any of us can because of your feeling for him. And he said, okay. So anyway, he did the filming, and I wasn't there on that day. I was away traveling, and the director said to me, David goes, wow. He said, right, it was his feeling today was just unbelievable. And I said, really? And then right, he texts me and he goes, I did the thing, but I'm not sure. You know, I ended up breaking down a bit on the film. And I said, look, Ian, I said, if you can edit it, you can do whatever you want to the piece. You can have it in however you want. I said, I've seen it. I went in to watch the edit. And obviously, it blew me away. And I said, it is absolutely you. That's all it is. It's you talking about your mate. I said, don't feel embarrassed about crying or being emotional. It absolutely captures the love you had for him. So that's all that matters to me. I said, if you don't want it in, I understand. But I said, we're close friends. I would never, ever let you down. I would never do something just for the sake of the film and let you down. So take it from me. It's brilliant. It's brilliantly put. And I think it should be in. But if you don't want it in... And he went, Dicko, that's good enough for me. That's fine. And it is such a beautiful moment. And I think that, you know, that's why I call the film a three hankier, because it's three times I cry in it every single time I watch it. And that's certainly one of them. It's an amazing piece of film.
Mm. I think Arsenal fans will love it. I'm not an Arsenal fan. I really loved it. So well done. And thanks a million, Lee.
Thanks, Joe. Cheers.
Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competitions.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had bought, he'd be my granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's right.